In the United States, a lot of the banks have banned their staff. So JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, do not allow their staff to use ChatGPT or other tools. To some degree, that's because the Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't have any guidance and nobody wants to be found out of compliance. So the great irony here is I think a lot of the industries that might benefit from these tools can't use them because of regulatory uncertainty.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von Handelsblatt Disrupt, dem Podcast über neue Ideen, Disruption und die Zukunft der digitalen Welt. Mein Name ist Sebastian Mattes und ich begrüße Sie wie immer ganz herzlich aus unserem Podcast-Studio hier in Düsseldorf. Kann künstliche Intelligenz eigentlich Hollywood-Blockbuster produzieren? Kann Bioengineering Krebs kurieren? Und was war eigentlich nochmal mit dem autonomen Fahren? Zu diesen und ganz vielen anderen Fragen hat unser Korrespondent im Silicon Valley, Stefan Scheuer, sich heute einen Gast eingeladen, den viele von Ihnen ebenfalls hier schon im Podcast gehört haben, nämlich Amy Webb. Sie ist eine der wichtigsten Zukunftsforscherinnen der Welt. Sie ist Gründerin des Future Today Institutes in New York und sie lehrt an der NYU Stern School of Business. Einmal im Jahr stellt sie einen detaillierten Bericht über die wichtigsten Tech-Trends des Jahres zusammen, den sie dann bei einer der wichtigsten Tech-Konferenzen in den USA vorstellt, der South by Southwest in Texas. Dieses Jahr spricht Amy Webb über die Ergebnisse ihres Reports exklusiv vorab mit Stefan Scheuer hier im Podcast. Und sie hat zu dem Gespräch auch ihre Europachefin Christina von Messling mitgebracht, die mit ihr gemeinsam den Bericht verfasst hat. In dem Gespräch geht es auch um die derzeit wohl wichtigste Frage: Was kann und vor allem was darf KI und was nicht? Im Silicon Valley ist in Sachen KI derweil eine Art Goldgräberstimmung ausgebrochen. Getrieben vom Erfolg des Tech-Roboters ChatGPT ist ein Wettrennen um die besten Lösungen und Geschäftsmodelle auf Basis von künstlicher Intelligenz entstanden.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Sie brauchen Klarheit bei dem Thema CO2-Grenzausgleichsmechanismus? Erfahren Sie, welche Aspekte Sie berücksichtigen müssen, um Bußgelder, unterbrochene Lieferketten und Reputationsschäden zu vermeiden. Klären Sie Ihre Fragen im Hinblick auf die neue Berichtspflicht im Online-Seminar am 6. Mai. Jetzt anmelden und mit dem Code PODCAST 15% bei der Anmeldung sparen. Alles weitere unter live.handelsblatt.com/cbam.
Und damit jetzt zu Stefan Scheuer und seinem Gespräch mit Amy Webb und Christina von Messling.
Hello Amy, hello Christina, thanks for having you guys.
Hey there.
Hi, glad to be here.
Okay, let's just jump right in. I always find the report very, very useful. Also for me as a journalist, as it does not only outline interesting areas, future areas of looking that are worthwhile looking into, but you are also going down to individual companies and individual technologies. And here in Silicon Valley, like what excites so many people is generative AI and AI in general. In your report, Amy, you gave the comparison that what we're seeing these days is comparable to the invention of the steam engine, which is quite an interesting comparison. Why do you think the impact is so big?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us. Christina and I are always delighted to talk about emerging trends. So we're happy to have this conversation. I think it's worthwhile to remember that last year at this time, everybody was talking nonstop about the metaverse. And 2 years ago at this time, everybody was talking nonstop about blockchain and cryptocurrencies, which is my way of saying we have shorter and shorter attention spans. And I think that's a problem because we start to lose perspective on how various technologies are shaping the future. So when I compare generative technologies to the steam engine, here's what I mean. I think this is an example of something called a general purpose technology, aka the other GPT. So a general purpose technology is one that has the potential to dramatically shape an economy, society, business, government. And the steam engine is a very clear example of that. At the time, the steam engine reshaped the certainly local economies and eventually the global economy. And after that, you know, there was the internet. The internet's a good example of a general purpose technology. If you were to try to calculate at this point the total value generated by the internet, you know, you really can't do it. It's impossible. The only way to do that is in the reverse. What would we lose if the internet was turned off? So that's where we are with AI. When it comes to generative AI specifically, what we're talking about are, you know, models that use trained data to spot patterns and then automatically make predictions or decisions. So in a way, this isn't really new. There are just some new techniques that have been developed over the past few years that have made their way into either publicly available or commercially available products, which is why everybody's talking about it so much right now.
And I mean, it's fascinating to see how fast the technology just developed within the last couple of months. I remember first playing around with this text-to-image technologies out there just about a year ago. You normally had like 5 legs, 10 fingers, and the faces look weird. And now it's sometimes difficult to tell them apart from a photo.
Sure. So for those who are not familiar, a text-to-image generator would be something where you sort of describe what you want, and then the system produces it for you, again, using different types of AI tools. There's one called DALL-E, which is a portmanteau of Salvador Dali and WALL-E, the cute robot creature from Pixar's animated movie. There's also something called Stable Diffusion. There's also something called Midjourney. There's a bunch out there. Now, I think it's worth noting that in the year 2020, when there, to be fair, there were a few other things happening that year. So you might not have heard about this, but the same company, OpenAI, that created the current ChatGPT system that has everybody all excited, they had an earlier version that in February of that year, they said that it was too dangerous to release to the general public, which on its own made headlines. So in a way, you know, I think it's just, again, it's worth noting, it feels like all of this kind of happened overnight, but it actually didn't. Now, relative to the very long trajectory of AI, which is hundreds of years old now, we've seen a lot of development in the past few years. But, you know, in 2017, Google wrote this sort of academic paper that, you know, wasn't super exciting, but for a few people, it sort of laid the foundation for a lot of these systems that exist today.
Which is super interesting, right? So Google laid the foundation that made a lot of those technologies possible, and now it's, in a lot of cases, other companies driving it. I mean, Christina, you looked into a lot of companies working in the field. What do you think, what are the most interesting ones, and what does that tell also about the position of Google?
Well, I think one of the most interesting ones that I just see, which is about to launch, is actually audio to video. So just again, like circling back to the speed of innovation here, like text to image is honestly almost like old school. Now there is all these new models already coming to the table. Video to video, audio to video, I find really fascinating. And again, just thinking about the speed of innovation, as well as the development of other specialized GPT developments, as well as generalized developments in this space, where they're not, you know, those models are not just able to analyze text, but also audio and video, everything together. So moving closer towards general AI, which to me is like the big development that's really exciting, even though I know that term always also raises a lot of fears.
I mean, generative AI, just for everybody to, is that we're on the same page, would be something like the Terminator that could do anything. And what we are normally at this point in time thinking about is AI that's trained for a very specific purpose. So looking at those specific purpose ones at the moment, you mentioned audio to video. Can you describe that? So I would say something and it would create a video, or what do you mean?
Exactly. That is a concept. So you don't even have to type anymore, as though you're giving a little, you know, on giving a little spiel of kind of, oh, that's what I have in mind, and it's turning it into a video. I think the video applications are still very in the very early stages. So no, I think there's no fear that there's going to be a feature film developments in the next, you know, couple of years that are just going to be produced by AI. But just by judging the extremely exponential development of this technology, I think we're going to have really quality stuff sooner rather than later.
Christina did, if I can just mention, in our trend report, we actually have a bunch of scenarios, which describes sort of what if conditions are right and these technologies to continue to develop, what might the future look like? Christina imagined a very interesting future in which a feature film was in fact created with the help of a generative AI system. You want to maybe just talk about that because it's super interesting?
Yes. Thank you, Amy, for setting that up, because that's actually one of my favorite scenarios. So just quickly, actually, in 2021, there was an AI that did develop or direct a movie. And I think it was at the Locarno Film Festival. It was at one European film festival. Please don't judge me if it was the wrong one. But the AI actually produced a Federico Fellini-style film. And it was still like supported by humans, but just alone that AI was called or did get a directing credit, I think definitely was a major signal towards development in that particular industry and the usage of AI and the future role of creatives.
Right. And, you know, speaking of sound and AI, Christina and I are in different places right now, and she's in Brooklyn where the streets are pretty loud. So like, I'm sure within the next year or two, it'll be possible for podcast people to just delete that audio, that additional audio, without taking away from what Christina said, or even editing out all of that sound and cloning her voice and just typing in the words and having a system generate audio from text that sound exactly like her, but without all that background noise.
At this point in time, maybe just a short shout out to a couple of companies here in Silicon Valley that are actually already working on this. Actually, one that we're using at the moment is called Descript, and they are already doing that. So you can actually take a piece of audio or video, they transcribe it, and you would be able to edit it in the same way that you would be able to edit a Word document. And what I found most fascinating is I can delete a sentence if I made a mistake, and I can rewrite it, and AI is going to speak the sentence in my voice, which today I still find quite puzzling and also interesting to think of what that might just make possible in the next years to come. So we talked about art, we talked about filmmaking, but there are so many other applications where artificial intelligence has an impact. So here in Silicon Valley, there are a lot of coders, and many of them are using GitHub Copilot as kind of an AI assistant helping them code their software. But I recently talked to executives from a large tech company, and they estimated that in the future, they will only need about 20% of all the coders they're having at the moment because of this AI gains being so big when filing computer code. What do you think? Where are the biggest impacts when it comes to workplaces, Amy?
Well, you know, there is a fairly famous German CEO who just the day before you, a couple of days, or maybe it was this morning before we are having this conversation, basically said that newsrooms will not need journalists anymore. And he is anticipating laying off a huge chunk of his staff globally. Do you know who I'm talking about, Stefan?
I don't know. I didn't follow that.
Yeah. So I'm trying to remember his name. He's the owner now of Politico and
Matthias Döpfner.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, like we can just do this journalism stuff without any actual journalists because you can just write whatever you want. Listen, I have spent an extraordinary amount of time with lots of different generative tools. So not just ChatGPT. I've been screwing around with, because I do write a little code on the side. So I've been playing with Copilot for a long time. And, you know, and outside of what everybody sort of has already heard of, there's also systems like Gatto, which is a multimodality. So this is a system from DeepMind that's multimodal, multitask. So it can do, it's a generalist generative AI, so it can do many different things at once. Part of the problem, so yes, I think at some point, hopefully, this will increase our productivity. But the one thing that I keep coming back to is that these systems are confidently wrong over and over and over again. I think this was ChatGPT, although at this point I can't remember which was which, just like a basic logic problem. And it explained the logic problem in great detail. And it was wrong. I mean, it had a very, like, it was very confident in the explanation, and it was a very deep explanation, and it was totally, totally incorrect. I had a Copilot. I was writing some Linux. It doesn't matter. I was writing a little tiny program, and it had some bugs in it. So I don't think we're at the point, and I think most developers know we're not quite at a point where we can just allow all of this to replace humans. I think as assistive technologies, they're very useful. I think we're going to wind up spending a lot more time copy checking, like copy editing and fact checking and debugging than we might have previously, which maybe means in the one hand, our productivity goes up. And on the other hand, our productivity goes way down because we're going to need to spend so much more time checking and correcting things.
It's quite difficult sometimes to spot the real mistakes that come out of those systems. I mean, there is a whole theoretical model behind this, hallucinations, how they're called when those models produce errors. But maybe, Christina, you can take us through a little bit on how jobs might change. You were talking Yes. about how we have a co-pilot for financial analysts, for commercial real estate developers, for lawyers. So how is AI going to change those jobs?
So really interesting that you're asking. I think one fundamental change that these tools will bring is just moving us from becoming actually the creators to editors. I'm now using terminology that's more creative, applicable to creative industries. But, if you're giving a command, ChatGPT is spitting out the answer, and then we need to, that's our foundation, and we need to edit. But it's for everybody who has written anything knows that, the creation process is extremely difficult and often painful. So I'm just curious how it will change us and our just mental abilities overall if we are outsourcing that work and shifting to another very obviously not worse or easier, but a very different skill set to editing.
Wait, could you just help us to better understand it? So I'm a lawyer, I get a case, I have to help a client, and I have my AI tool. So the AI tool is going to solve the case for me, and I'm just going to proofread it? Or what do you mean?
No, but for example, maybe the lawyer is giving a certain commands about, okay, these are the laws you should use. Please write the case out for me. So, and then, obviously, so the foundation is done, and then he's going through or write the letter to the client for me. And then he's going to go through and then edit that. And, as ChatGPT is becoming better and better, probably less and less edits need to be made. And especially as also like specific ChatGPTs are being developed, then those are being able to produce more precise answers. So as an actual worker, we are more moving into the editing rather than the actual creation of materials of work. That's what I mean. And that's a very different skill set.
In your reports, what you always look on is not only the technologies, but also the impact on business. So, Amy, what would be your recommendation for businesses now thinking about whether this is going to have an impact and how they should react to it? Should they have like a chief artificial AI officer, or what's the right approach?
Well, I think that at the moment, some industries are hamstrung because of regulatory challenges. So in the United States, a lot of the banks have banned their staff. So JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, do not allow their staff to use ChatGPT or other tools. To some degree, that's because the Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't have any guidance, and nobody wants to be found out of compliance. So the great irony here is I think a lot of the industries that might benefit from these tools can't use them because of regulatory uncertainty. And so that impacts basically everybody in financial services, not just in the United States, but in Germany and really all throughout the world. And when I talk about financial services, I'm talking about banking and also insurance, which is another place that this could be a tool for value creation. And instead, I think it's going to be challenging for those places to use these tools. You know, we're on the cusp of APIs being developed. The business models are being created right now. And, you know, if because of regulation, you're not allowed to use these tools, that's fine. Don't use them, but at least get together as a company and start thinking through strategy. I don't think we need chief generative AI officers or anything like that. I do think that the leaders of organizations, executives who are charged with setting a 5-year strategic plan or a longer term vision for the organization, they do need to have familiarity with what these tools are and how they can be used. It sounds simplistic, you know, you just ask a system a question and it spits out an answer, but that's actually not what's happening. You're going to have to make decisions about which data you allow once these systems get white labeled. You're going to have to figure out what the implications are for your customers. And again, how you're going to generate value in the era of assisted computing. Because for a lot of industries, that's going to have to change.
Just looking a little bit beyond artificial intelligence, there are so many other areas where a lot has been evolving within the past year and where a lot probably will be evolving in the upcoming month. One area that I find particularly interesting is robotics, because, Amy, we have talked about developments in robotics throughout the past year several times, and there was this traditional notion that they would be taking off the dreary, hardworking jobs. But looking at the situation now, we've seen this amazing advancements in artificial intelligence when it comes to creative works. Mm-hmm. But those traditional hard labor works, there are limitations when looking at robotics. I was recently in an Amazon facility, and there's still thousands of people working there. So why is it so difficult to advance in those areas?
I think this is one of these cases where we had expectations and reality did not meet the expectations that we had. I think most people thought the robots are coming to take our jobs, right? So truck driving and plumbing and the trades. I think, you know, we certainly told our clients this, but like anybody who knows anything about activities requiring fine motor skills could tell you that there's just too much variability when it comes to training a robot to fix a thing or to operate a thing, right? And so if you think about construction sites or inside of a home or an office, there's so much variation that, you know, it'll be a very long time before we can get robots to replace humans. Now, what about places where you have repetitive tasks and there is less variation? So you mentioned Amazon and warehouses. Well, in that case, you know, what can a robot do faster, more efficiently, more safely than a human? To some degree, it is repetitive tasks, but at the moment, it's still cheaper for a human to do them. So the kind of sick irony thing that's happened is that there are lots of robots in warehouses, and they are humans, right? It's the AI systems that are doing the cognitive work. I'm sure this is what you saw, right? And people are doing the moving stuff around work, because at the moment it's still faster, cheaper for us to do it. That will change over time. But I think the challenge is we've been living with this idea of walking, talking robots for so long. You know, and it's like we don't recognize other things as automated systems and robots. Some of the most interesting work that we've actually seen in robotics is in soft robotics or wet robots, which crosses over into bioengineering and biotech.
Yeah, maybe just to add to this point, what I'm not only thinking about is in the warehouse, but we saw so many other pilot projects. Just coming back to Amazon, for example, there was this pilot project with home delivery robots, Scout, mm-hmm. and yeah. They scrapped that. last year. In the report, you pointed to a European company, Starship, who's basically doing the same with also robots going through town, delivering parcels, for example. Do you still see a big future for this? Maybe, Christina, mm-hmm. this is something that you could help us better understand.
Happy to jump in. So I actually wanted to quickly circle us back to it's surprising now that generative AI is threatening a different level of jobs, so that those manual labor jobs like plumbers, they'll be fine for quite a long time, because until robots are able to have these the abilities to do these complex, flexible, you know, types of work, it'll be a very long time. But white collar work, which are just more low level, I heard that right now ChatGPT is kind of on the level of a mediocre graduate student. Not sure if that is, you know, you can always say that, but you know, in general, that is more the level of jobs that are in danger of being reduced rather than the manual labor. So.
I would just say one quick thing on Scout. So oftentimes people will point at Amazon that scraps a program that felt very consequential, and then they scrap the program and everybody assumes, oh, they failed or it's dead or pivoting or whatever. That is usually not what's happening with Amazon. You know, Amazon quietly launches things, they learn from them, and usually it's part of something else. And I would not say that just because Scout seems dead, that Amazon is not very much thinking about automated deliveries.
The reason why I was pointing to it is that the pressure for innovation, especially with a company like Amazon, was so high during the pandemic. It was so difficult to get people. Amazon was the driving force also in increasing minimum wages in the US, because they paid so much more than the minimum wage was in many of the American states. So I find they are really interesting case study, also given how much they spend on R&D. So maybe let us look beyond what we saw with Scout and others. Where do you see the most interesting developments when looking at robotics these days?
Christina, do you want to start? And then I've got some.
Yes, I can start. So for me, the most interesting development in robotics are in remote operations. So just because, especially in Kong, you know, taken together with the shortage of healthcare workers, and especially also in American rural areas, but also I know in Germany, where in rural areas, healthcare is just not sufficient. If we are able to have remote operations, then that would be just such an incredible benefit for our overall healthcare. So all the developments in that particular space are the ones that I'm most excited about.
And I would say, I know we don't think of these as being robots, but there are so many interesting new developments in bioengineering to create organic, squishy, tiny robots that can maneuver through your body to do things like deliver targeted therapies to very specific parts of your body, leave behind a tiny something or another to separate some tissue. Those are also robots. And there's just like a phenomenal amount of work being done right now in that space. In fact, some researchers in the past couple of months trained an organism how to play tic-tac-toe, which it learned how to replicate and do over and over again. And, you know, these were, you know, tiny little organisms that don't have brains, and they were using computers and other tools to communicate with them.
Which is really interesting. So the difference between an organism and a machine is basically changing these days, right? You also had examples of, for example, sensors that are based on living cells that then produced, I think it was for detecting in AirPods. Maybe Christina, what else should we have on our radar when it comes to biotechnology? In the past, we talked about CRISPR and what advancements are possible with CRISPR.
Yeah. Actually, CRISPR-based antibiotics are really exciting, because the antibiotic resistance is something that I think is not being talked about enough. And if we find a way to deal with that, I think that is great. I love that. And then I'm also very excited about organoids, so body on a chip technology, where I see both of you nodding, just as a reference for the listener. So, which is basically where tiny cells are put on a chip that represent or different organs of the body, so that medication can be tested in those tiny systems, making animal testing obsolete. And also, it's testing is much better because we're actually testing on human cells. Those are a couple of them, but handing it over to Amy.
Yeah, so again, I think the place that we are right now with bioengineering is still very much picks and shovels, which is to say the sort of underlying technologies are what I think are probably most important at the moment. And those range from being able to synthesize and sequence genes faster, meaning once you have the genetic material that you can decode what's there and then create it, replicate it faster. So that doesn't sound very exciting. But we are now at a place where that's scalable and that's super important. There's an overlap between biology and artificial intelligence, which is why a lot of people sort of pay attention to both. So there's a lot happening with machine learning and machine learning powered drug discovery. And believe it or not, generative AI, which we were just talking about, there are companies now, there's a company called Absci, A-B-S-C-I, that is using generative AI to create de novo antibodies, which is sort of a way of saying creating new types of antibodies that have never existed before that they know of in nature. And you may say to yourself, like, this is super, why do I care? This is like super in the weeds, And the reason is because antibodies are like really important. That's what our immune system sort of works on. That's what is how we might someday fight cancer, and being able to suss some of this out is super, super important.
So we have gene editing, we have gene therapy. So what are the most interesting applications when just thinking, there might be, somebody might be prone towards a disease to really fix it?
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Zinsen, Immobilien, Geopolitik, das Jahr der Entscheidungen. Das ist das Motto des diesjährigen Bankengipfels. Banken sehen sich gerade mit einer Vielzahl von Krisen konfrontiert. In dieser Situation sind unabhängige Information und Orientierung wichtiger denn je. Beim Bankengipfel erwarten Sie daher News und Networking sowie wertvolle Impulse von Vordenkern aus Banken und Tech. Wir freuen uns auf Sie am 4. und 5. September in Frankfurt. Mit dem Vorteilscode Bankengipfel24 erhalten Sie 15% auf den Teilnehmerpreis unter handelsblatt-bankengipfel.de.
Right, so gene editing, that would be like CRISPR, where you have molecular scissors, as they're sort of known, that allow you to go in and sort of snip out what you don't want. So in the past year, there's been a lot of research. There was this huge audit of viral genomes, and it showed all these new potential CRISPR editing tools that can be used. There's a lot that's being done in that space. Part of it is we sort of need to understand which enzyme to use for what, and where to make some of those snips and edits. So some of the first trials have to do with eradicating sickle cell anemia, which is a horrible heritable disease, and also some treatments having to do with blindness and low vision. So that's CRISPR, that's editing. Cell therapy is different. This is about transplanting healthy, viable cells so that you can repair damaged ones or even replace them. It's an interesting area of science. There are some risks. The risks can range from feeling like you've got the flu to death, which is horrible. So there's a lot of new work being done to figure out, again, like how can you have new genetic instructions in cells and by doing a transplantation like that, can you regress something like leukemia? So that's some of the work that's being done in animals right now. If you've ever heard of something called CAR-T, C-A-R-T cells, that's where some of this work is being done. Again, we're early days. A lot of this is still very much in a laboratory and not being performed, you know, on the general public, as far as we know.
And then we are basically in this phase where, as a result of the pandemic, there has been so much attention being paid to the development, research, and also the production of vaccinations, but also diseases in general. So there were quite a few scientists who said, well, the pandemic was super, super bad, but a positive outcome might be that we got way closer of solving diseases such as cancer. Is that true? What's your take on it?
Well, I don't know that we're that much closer to solving cancer. I think the difference is, you know, again, our regulators, both in Germany, which has very strict regulators, by the way, and in the United States, they don't want to flip-flop. They don't want to change their regulations constantly because their job really is to make sure that people are safe and that communities are safe. So that's great. We don't want them changing their mind a lot. That being said, it's not like they themselves innovate. So the technology that made the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines possible, the messenger RNA vaccines possible, that's been around for a decade. The problem was regulatory hurdles and investment and use cases. You know, unfortunately, sometimes we have really powerful technologies, but regulators kind of don't have a playbook for how to regulate those things because they've never seen them before. And that stifles movement into the market. So I don't know that we're that much closer to having a cancer vaccine. We do, however, now have an enormous set of new tools which will allow us to get further ahead. And I think that also sparked, certainly in the United States and in other places around the world, renewed desire to invest in biotech. So the Biden administration announced an executive order, which is going to clear the way for funding and in research and in biotechnologies and bioengineering, which the U.S. sees as a fundamental part of its economy going forward. But we are also seeing that in China, which is in the process of reorganizing its government as we speak, but we anticipate that being one outcome. And we're also seeing huge investment in the Middle East and in Saudi Arabia in particular into some of these technologies. So I think we're going to start to see, I think if anything, the virus acted as a catalyst for a lot of this.
So we've been mostly talking about how it could help treating diseases, but there are also quite a lot of people looking at those technologies to increase their lifespan. Longevity has been one of those topics that's out there for quite a while, and there have been some recent interesting developments. What do you make of it? Is it something feasible that the idea was always, I don't know, we might reach a point in our lifespan where we would be able to increase our life longer than we would originally have to live. Is this feasible?
But we've done that right now, right? I'm in my late 40s. And if you go back in time 200 years, I would be an elder, right? And I've got friends who are my age who are having babies. So my point in saying this is that we've always innovated science and technology for the purpose of life extension. That has always been the case. That will very likely always be the case going forward. I think what we are on the cusp of right now is something that is maybe just more exponential. So not increasing life by spans by maybe 2 to 5 years, but potentially by, you know, 15 to 20 years or even longer than that. So a lot of this research is sort of asking, can we think of aging as a pathology that can be treated versus sort of an inevitability? And there is more money being poured into this right now. I mean, unimaginable amounts of money being poured into this relative to other emerging areas of science and tech. I'm seeing investment rounds, public and private, like that are nothing like I've seen before. Billions and billions and billions of dollars.
I mean, we're living at the moment. I think the official forecast for men and women in the US are around 85 years. What do you think? Are we going to see a breakthrough thinking about this exponential growth that you have been mentioning? How long are you going to live? Like what time span are you looking at?
Stefan, what kind of futurist do you think I am here? We don't make predictions. We make preparations. So along that line, I think that's a lot. That explains a lot of what's happening. I think there will be a trickle-down impact if we play our cards right, and hopefully this will improve health outcomes for everybody. But if we don't organize ourselves correctly, then I think this just increases the sort of socioeconomic divide even further. And you wind up with people who are able to live longer, healthier lives because they can afford it, and everybody else who just doesn't become the recipient of this research.
So we're back to the moral question, right? But thinking about the moral question, there is also another one, like another technological area where a lot of development has been taking place. And this is this human brain interface where we, for example, had well-known companies such as Neuralink, who originally announced their first trials, human trials, for last year, and they have been postponed. Do you think in this area there will be a lot of development? I mean, the idea is not only that blind people might be able to see, but that all of us might have a more intuitive way of getting information or sharing information.
I mean, with who though? We're, you know, here's the thing. Like, nobody needs Neuralink to communicate with a tech company. We are already doing that. And a lot of the early brain machine interface technology was really designed not for commercial use, but for stroke victims. So people who have stroke or Parkinson's, who cognitively still have the ability to move their bodies or to speak, but just have, there's a disconnect between the muscles or the neuromuscular system and the brain.
I think one of the interesting developments in that space is the development of the bionic nose. I know that you wrote about that, which I think is interesting. So about the nose has been too complex to replace because just it's so many, there's like a trillion different smells and like you can't fit that many sensors on a small chip. But first efforts have been actually made to now be able to do that with the help of smart glasses and different sensors being in the glasses and then connecting to the olfactory center. So I thought that was, it's just always incredible when you hear about these developments and what it can do for people. No.
When I was at the CES conference, there was one startup presenting this kind of nose experience, and it was basically just like something blowing into your face, and it was a really horrible experience. So I think it would be really nice if there would be a better way of experiencing scents than I don't know, have a perfume being sprayed into your face.
Well, I can give you a little preview of something I'm going to talk about at South By related to scents, if you want.
Yeah, please do.
So there, again, in the sort of weird Venn diagram of bioengineering and generative AI, Google has created a new database that predicts smells, including things like body odor. So, and like, this is actually really, really complicated to do because you have to know the molecular structure of all of these different things. So again, they've like figured that out. Now, the question is, why would you do that? And one early example is mosquitoes. If you can figure out what mosquitoes don't want to smell, then you could potentially generate that smell and keep the mosquitoes away, which would be awesome. Do you know what else you might be able to keep away, Stefan? What else is like... What else is like a mosquito? Drunk people. Oh. Drunk people at bars are like pests, right? So like maybe we can generate a smell to keep them away, or better yet, maybe we can have a little decoder and know whether they're drunk before they start coming to you. But you could start taking this a step further. What if you've got an empty room and you have police investigating a crime scene and there's no physical evidence that you can see, but maybe they have like a digital bloodhound that can detect scents, right?
So I could smell if somebody was in the room a couple of hours earlier.
Yeah. So I think this is the kind of thing where, again, like we have to keep in mind that the technology works as a human interface on us, but also in the world. And we should be thinking about what does that potentially mean?
There is one other area that I wanted to ask you about. And this is this level of digital infrastructure, because a lot of the technological developments that we're talking about is based on getting a lot of people access to fast internet connections. And the traditional approach has always been having a fiber connection, a wired connection, or building cell phone towers. But within the last couple of months, we've seen that, for example, Starlink has been put up an online network. And when we were traveling here in the US, we had several areas where we had no cell phone reception, but perfect Starlink receptions. We see probably throughout the next couple of months that normal mobile phones here in the US will be able to connect to a satellite. So how is this going to change the way digital infrastructure works?
So again, this is one of these things that's sort of not new. But I think telecommunications, which we have a lot of experience with, you know, this is an industry that I would argue has not really been innovating and has not really been thinking through sort of when we think about the farther future. In fact, over the past, I don't know, 6 years, 7 years, maybe longer, every time I've brought up low Earth orbit satellites and CubeSats and just alternative means for transmission, you know, I get the same response, whether I'm talking to a telecommunications executive in Germany or the Nordics or the United States, and that is, but the latency, but there's no bandwidth, but, right? It's never going to be as fast. It's never going to be as good. And the question I have to keep asking is, but what if it's free? What if somebody comes in and offers slightly less good, but completely free internet from space, right? In fact, that's what we're seeing. So Starlink is, to some degree, offering it for free now. So there's Ukraine, spotty, but still. And in the United States, there's a new, literally kicking off right now, a T-Mobile Starlink partnership, where if you're a T-Mobile subscriber and you're in a traditional dead zone where you don't get connectivity, Starlink will provide it for you for free. This represents a pretty big change to an industry. And who's to say that Starlink isn't making an ecosystem play, that, you know, the margins don't matter to them as much as it might to a traditionalist in the telecom space. And they just offer internet for free going forward. You know, this represents a few things. There's been an underinvestment in digital infrastructure in general, even though we see adoption rates and new types of technologies increasing steadily. There's been a total lack of innovation when it comes to business models, I think, in the telecommunications space. And all of that is going to change whether or not people in the industry want it to.
And it probably is also going to change this entire notion of having black or white spots, right?
Sure.
In the past, it was very expensive to get the approval for a cell phone site. And there are so many people who don't want it in their background, but you don't see a satellite. So there is an interesting other topic that you basically mentioned, and this is the role that the technology played in the war in Ukraine. So we have a much wider overlap between a private company and a state actor with the war in Ukraine. The Europeans now want their own because they don't want to be reliable on Elon Musk, who's basically the person behind Starlink. So is that even possible? Because you only have limited space in around Earth where satellites can maneuver around.
Yeah, and we're just talking about Starlink. There's also Kuiper, which is Amazon. There's a whole bunch of startups. I can't remember the name of the company, but the FCC in the United States declined their application to launch their own sort of micro CubeSat network. So they hitched a ride on an Indian rocket instead. So the other interesting thing is when you're talking about low Earth orbit, it's not like any one country has any jurisdiction over, right? So, and there's a desire to get a lot of stuff up there, not just from the United States, but also from European countries, certainly from China. So, you know, we could wind up with a mess. And actually, in the trend report, there's an entire chapter just on space and the challenges that some of this will start causing if we don't figure out ways to coordinate.
Yeah, we also see it at the moment, for example, with the spy balloons. I mean, we had this whole discussion about, is China spying? And suddenly there were so many people pointing to, oh, there is a balloon, there is one. Right. So the space above us is getting increasingly crowded, huh?
It is getting increasingly crowded. Sorry, just to insert myself here quickly. And like the FCC did approve like thousands and thousands of launches of new satellites. And then the that technology also comes with new risks, because what if then, you know, there's collisions up there which can have like a domino effect, which is something that is, you know, we're sometimes talking about, but I think isn't getting enough attention. Also, the environmental effects of having those so many satellites up there, just from the launch, the kerosene in the atmosphere, as well as then the dissolving of the materials, are also things that if this is becoming now suddenly a major form of connection, that we need to take into consideration.
Yeah, especially thinking about the whole number of satellites that you need in the low Earth orbit to have a worldwide system. I think Starlink is looking at 20,000, Kuiper from Amazon, they want to do it with about 5. But you would definitely need a huge number. There's one last topic I wanted to talk to you about, and this is a traditional one that we have been talking about in the past years, but where we've seen a lot of development. What I'm talking about is autonomous driving. So for years and years, companies, and namely Elon Musk, has been forecasting the start of fully autonomous taxi services that has never materialized. But living in San Francisco, now we have two startups that are actually without drivers driving around the city, Waymo, Google-owned startup, and Cruise, the GM-owned startup. So how do you see this field? Are we now maybe after this phase of a more conservative view on what's going on at a breakthrough? Are we going to see robo-taxis?
Yeah, I don't know at what point everybody got together and decided that Elon Musk's predictions were rooted in any kind of data or evidence. I don't get it. I don't get him. I don't get everybody's fascination. I don't get it. So
okay, it was not only Elon Musk talking about the start of robo taxis.
It was a lot of him, and his voice does carry quite a bit of weight. So let's think through what would it take for us to have fully autonomous taxi fleets. The technology would have to be ready. We're talking about a significant and fundamental shift in how technology works. So that's going to take a little bit of time. I think we've made great strides, but again, there's a lot of variability, and we have very powerful computer vision recognition systems right now, but it's still, there's a lot that has to be done. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we have a lot of different types of urban areas. So it's much more probable that fully autonomous vehicles would operate like between Santa Fe and Phoenix, where you have long stretches of highway and not a lot of interesting things happening, versus inside of New York City, where just 2 days ago I was in a car. I do a lot of scenarios thinking just all the time. So I happened to be in the car, and I was like, okay, well, what would it take for fully autonomous vehicles to work in Manhattan around our office? And there's so much that's variable. And the thing that made me think about this was I hate these delivery drivers that are now using electric bikes on the sidewalk, which is totally not where they're supposed to be. And I almost got hit with one the other day. You have the introduction of tourists, people walking when they're not supposed to. So anyhow, I figured the only way this would actually work is if at a crosswalk, walls go up on each side to prevent anybody from crossing the street. Anyhow, I kept going on and on and on thinking through, and finally I got to the end, which is I don't think there could ever be fully autonomous vehicles in New York City.
Interesting. I mean, they are already on the streets here in San Francisco, right?
You would have to have conditions such that the technology will work effectively. And then also you have to have regulators and you have to have insurers and financiers. I mean, you just, it's a huge ecosystem, and whether the tech might move fast, but the insurers might, you know, understandably move super slow. So Elon can say whatever he feels like, I guess. But I would be like, if I'm mapping out the time horizons, I would be looking at other things besides just the technology.
Interesting that you're quite quite conservative when it comes to this, because in this field, we also have a couple of German companies. So in the report, you also mentioned Mercedes, who got the first approval for level 3, meaning the car is doing most of it, but still you need a driver behind the wheel. And if it crashes, Mercedes is actually going to pay for it. So there was no insurer. They are the company who are bearing the cost because they're so confident that it works. We're going to find out if that's also the case for the long run. That was super, super interesting. We covered a lot of ground, many, many different topics. I learned a lot, and I'm looking forward to touching base with you guys in maybe a year when we can see what actually materialized of what we talked about today. Thank you so much. Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Thank you.
Und damit sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende von Handelsblatt Disrupt. Wie immer freue ich mich über Kommentare in der Handelsblatt Disrupt LinkedIn-Gruppe oder senden Sie mir gerne eine Mail. Die Details finden Sie in den Shownotes. Danke an dieser Stelle auch für die Unterstützung von Lukas Teppler und Regina Körner und Migo Fecke von professionalpodcast.com, dem Dienstleister für Strategieberatung und Podcastproduktion. Wenn Sie grundsätzlich immer auf dem Laufenden sein wollen, dann testen Sie doch gerne unser Handelsblatt-Vorteilsangebot. Damit lesen Sie die aktuellen Artikel plus alles aus dem Archiv für 4 Wochen für nur 1 Euro. Schauen Sie doch einfach mal nach unter handelsblatt.com/Mehrwirtschaft. Die Details dazu finden Sie in den Shownotes. Wir hören uns dann nächste Woche Freitag wieder. Bis dahin wünsche ich Ihnen interessante digitale, aber natürlich auch analoge Zeiten. Ihr Sebastian Mattes.
Die deutsche Wirtschaft steht vor neuen Herausforderungen. Und Sie möchten aktiv die Zukunft mitgestalten? Dann sind Sie beim Handelsblatt CFO Summit 2024 genau richtig. Erleben Sie hochkarätige Speaker und CFOs renommierter Unternehmen wie Amazon, Google oder SAP. Seien Sie Teil dieses exklusiven Gipfeltreffens am 11. und 12. Juni in Düsseldorf. Mit dem Code PODCAST sparen Sie bei der Anmeldung 15%. Alle weiteren Infos unter handelsblatt-cfo-summit.de.